at item two, open public comment. I think I have three individuals have signed up. I'd like all three of you to come up at once. David Lynn, Steve Franson, and Robert Sudar. All of you been here before. You know the rules, the policy, and the sound of the gong. Nikki, please show them the new sound when it means they're done. There you go. We don't have a buzzer, so there you go. David.
Chairman, Commissioners, and Director, good morning. I'm David Lynn from Ocean Shores, representing myself. We've all seen brain teasers where we are shown three images and asked to determine what is the same or what is different about these images. Well, I have one for you today. The year was 2012. The family was called the Wedge Pack. Its seven members were exterminated by Director Phil Anderson, and the offending ranch was Diamond M. The year was 2016. The family was called the Profanity Peak Pack. Its seven members were exterminated by Director Jim Unsworth, and the offending ranch was Diamond M. The year was 2019. The family was called the OPT Pack. Its eight members were exterminated by Director Kelly Suswind, and the offending ranch was Diamond M. So what is the common element in each of these depredations? You guessed it. Diamond M Ranch was involved in each of these mass killings. Further to the point, 26 of the 31 wolves killed by the department since 2012 have been caused by Diamond M Ranch. So what will you do about this? Will you continue to countenance the killing of our wildlife, or will you require that Diamond M properly care for its livestock? I was glad to see that Governor Inslee has listened to the citizens of the state and sent a letter to Director Suswind saying this rampant killing of wolves must stop. Will you also listen to your constituents, or you can continue down this same path? The department reported an increase of four wolves from last year, but has already killed nine this year. That is not sustainable. As I have noted in previous comments to this commission, the current wolf-livestock interaction protocol is deeply flawed and results in the unjustifiable killing of our wolves. These wolves, like all of our wildlife, are held in trust by the state for our citizens and should not be so callously slaughtered. I'm here to ask you to do something to fix the problem and not simply continue to attack the symptoms. The Kettle River Range is prime wolf habitat, but only marginal grazing land for cattle. In fact, it is so rugged that the killing must be done from a helicopter. Turning to a more specific situation, on August 16th, the department killed the remaining four wolves of the OPT family. This was done just hours before Judge McHale ruled in favor of an injunction to stop the killing. His ruling held that there was sufficient reason to hear the merits of the case in court and that the remaining wolves should not be killed. Believing that it would likely lose this case, the department rushed to eliminate the last four members of the OPT family to avoid the court's decision and render its ruling moot. This deliberate action to circumvent the legal system places an indelible stain on this department that will last far beyond any of us here today. By this action, the department affirms that it values expediency over justice. By this action, the department has said to those of us who do care about our environment and our wildlife that we don't matter. By this action, the department has closed its ears, refusing to hear our voices. Now is the time to reorient this commission to recognize that it represents all of the citizens of the state and not just a few. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, David. Steve?
Good morning, Commissioners and Director. I'm Steve Franson. Maybe some of you remember me from Occupy Skagit. Fishing the Skagit River is very near and dear to me. And I wrote to you in June about my concern that the department's anadromous fish section of the fish program is out of touch with citizen taxpayers and licensed buyers. It's biting the hand that feeds it by throwing recreational fishing under the bus and spending its resources on other activities. Optics. Please think about that. Last May, Director Suswin issued a memo describing the department's budget situation and that cuts may be necessary, including the Skagit steelhead fishing season, because of the cost of monitoring, which was up to nearly $200,000, as required by the NIMS approved resource management plan under ESA regulations. Optics again. The department lacks sufficient funding to monitor the Skagit steelhead season, yet under an agreement with the Wild Fish Conservancy, the department stopped raising and stocking hatchery steelhead smolts in the Skagit River about 6 years ago. That costs over $200,000 a year. Where is that money? and why isn't it available for steelhead fishery monitoring? Shortly after the budget memo, Director Sustlin announced his intention to create two top-tier management positions in the department during this severe budget crisis. There's another $200,000 that won't be available to fund Skagit steelhead monitoring. The department lacks sufficient funding to monitor the Skagit steelhead season. However, out of $128.7 million spent on hatchery operations, 72.8% or $93.7 million is spent on hatchery salmon and steelhead. Mostly salmon, since hatchery steelhead production has already been reduced by 65% in Puget Sound alone, and over half of those hatchery salmon are caught in Canada, some in Alaska. Of those that return to Washington, most are caught in commercial and treaty fisheries, with a few accruing to recreational anglers, the people who buy department licenses and pay taxes to support the department's existence. And the department lacks sufficient funding to monitor the Skagit steelhead season. At the June 15th meeting in Port Angeles, two colleagues from Occupy Skagit spoke with you about reasons to continue the Skagit steelhead season. Commissioner Carpenter, you expressed that Occupy Skagit performed well in advocating for a reopening of the Skagit steelhead season and developing the plan that made that happen. But where were we during the legislative session in regards to the department's budget issues? I'm sorry I didn't attend the June meeting, or I would have told you that, well, actually, we were present, urged on by the Coastal Conservation Association, and others to lobby against the department's request for increased general fund appropriations, increased license fees, and extension of the Columbia River endorsement fee. This happened because of angler perception that they were double-crossed by the department and commission for rescinding the 2013 policy to phase out non-treaty commercial gill netting in the lower Columbia River. Optics, there's that word again.
Steve, try
one sentence.
Bit, wrap it up if you can.
And you want us to lobby the legislature for increased funds while you continue this path of reducing recreational angling opportunity. Think again, more tomorrow. Thank you. And despite this criticism, I really appreciate the work you guys do. It's mission impossible.
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Sudar.
I changed my testimony a little bit based on what I heard this morning. Rob Sudar from Longview, a commercial representative for the Columbia River area. I'm disappointed to hear that you don't want to make a decision perhaps in Bellingham in December. We've been working towards that for a year. Also, the new committee has been working on that for over a year. Kicking the can down the road again. You're not going to get any more people in Vancouver that are going to get any testimony that you haven't heard before. This has been going on for 7 years. You hear the same thing every time. You hear the people in the red hat show up and complain about how horrible the gillnets are. You hear us show up, try to present the science that shows we aren't a horrible fishery that everybody thinks we are. You're not going to hear anything new. We're already planning to go to Bellingham because of that, because it matters to us. This process has been going on. The review process started almost 2 years ago. If any of you haven't looked through the document, I suggest you do. As Commissioner Thorburn mentioned, no conservation in this plan is an allocation plan. And nothing new is going to come out of it. It took 2 months to develop the policy in the first place. And the recommendation came from a small group of commissioners who were working with staff who presented it at our second meeting in October of 2012. And there had been no discussion about where that policy came from. They just had the document. And in November, it was approved. I mean, that's how fast that happened. 20 months later, we still don't have a decision on the review process. And the Policy Review Committee has been trying to formulate a plan that fits the schedule. And now we say we don't have enough time for public input. I get so frustrated. The people who come to the meetings are the ones who care about policy. You see me way more than you want to see me because it matters to me. You see half a dozen other people in our committee, in our group, show up because it matters to our industry and to our communities. You don't see very many recreational people show up until there's a big gathering to get all the red hats here to rant about how horrible gillnets are. I mean, make the decision. You've spent a lot of time getting a lot of money getting the data. This should be a science-based decision. This should not be a political decision, but that's what it's turning into. Using us as the bargaining chip in regards to financing for the department, it's so frustrating. If anything, the policy was supposed to increase recreational trips. It didn't. It showed that there's not a linear relationship between angler trips and allocation. It was supposed to create more license sales. It didn't. It did hammer our industry. There was no conservation gain. There was no improvement in PHAWs. That's in this document. There's no reason you can't make this decision in Bellingham. You'll have an idea about concurrency because Oregon will have made their decision the week before. Policy Review Committee is trying to get through this. I've attended almost all of those meetings. I appreciate the chance to ask you a comment, but honestly, going to the Tri-Cities and then getting another group in Vancouver where you rustle up all those sports guys to come and tell tales about how horrible we are is not going to make the decision any easier for you, and it's not going to add any science to the decision.
Thank you, Robert. You do realize, though, that transparency and open public process is very important to what we have to do, and we're not trying to kick the can down the road. I can assure you that.
Well, as I said yesterday at the Fish Committee meeting, we all knew that the decision was going to happen in Spokane. We commented when that was first announced that that's not a very good place to hold a decision on this, but that was still the decision at that time where it was going to happen. We did have a few people who were there to testify because of that. I did not choose to go to Spokane for that. But, you know, if the transparency is what you want to see it to be, there's been a lot of opportunity to comment on this. There's been a lot of science. I'm frustrated that people say it's all done in secret. There's nothing done in secret here. There's been lots of opportunity. The facts are the facts, and there's nothing that in our fishery that's impairing the recovery of these stocks on the Columbia. We stay within our management goals better than the recreational fishery does. We have better data, it's faster, you get it the day after our fishery. It's not making the decision in Bellingham, it's just avoiding making a hard choice.
Thank you for your comments, Robert.
Thank you for the time.
We're number three, director's report. Kelly?
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. So a little change up in how we're going about this time. This is based on some input from commissioners. So we've changed the format of our director's report that you have in your written materials. So hopefully you've all seen that. More of a magazine format, intended to be a little more accessible, a little more enticing, and definitely it's prettier than what we had before. So it's a work in progress. Very interested in your input. Love it, hate it, tweak it. Would love to hear back from you at any time. Trying to make this usable to you all as commissioners. The other thing we've heard is a desire to hear a little more of a lightning round of just kind of what issues we've been working on and where basically I've been spending my time in my role as for the agency. So on big issues, one of the biggest issues we have is we did issue a letter to the Secretary of Interior regarding the Skokomish Reservation and where the boundary line lies. So we've got a long history of this for a number of years. It's really, what I want to emphasize is this is not intended as any way to affect treaty rights, treaties, or disrespect for any tribe, particularly the Skokomish. This is a boundary line adjustment, a boundary line dispute. I'm sorry, go ahead.
A boundary of the reservation or ceded lands?
Of the reservation. So I think it was 2012, submitted a letter to the solicitor suggesting that the boundary of the reservation would include the river itself, the Skokomish River. The solicitor issued an opinion that that was the case. You'll recall that's when we basically started pulling back on our recreational fisheries in that area because it was unclear who owned that river and whether we had the authority to issue or exercise that. And a concern that if we did issue it or commence with a season, prosecute a season, with that uncertainty that our fishers would be subject to potentially federal prosecution for trespass. We did a lot of work a couple of years through our AG's office, gathered a lot of data. We are feeling pretty confident that the reservation actually extends to the northern boundary of the river, leaving the river off of the reservation. Bottom line, let's figure it out. Let the solicitor look at this information. We have information that was not considered in the previous determination. And we've offered and continue to offer to sit down with the Skokomish tribe and work this out as well. So I just wanted you to know about it because it's a big deal when you start talking about the boundary reservations, and we fully understand and respect that. But I do think it's to the benefit of the tribe and to the citizens to understand where that line really sits.
So just to be clear, this is before the Solicitor General. It is not in court.
It's before the Solicitor General, which is a non-binding opinion, but the opinion we have so far is that the river is included in the reservation.
Okay.
We would like them to reconsider that determination or that position, I should say. Determination makes it sound stronger. That position based on the information we submitted. Moving on kind of the lightning round piece of where I've been spending some time. So I went to the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies in Minneapolis. It's the first time I've attended that broader meeting. I focused primarily on the elements of or the segments of that meeting that focused on relevancy. We talk a lot about relevancy here in our state. It's common throughout the country. I don't think there were any fish and wildlife agencies there that weren't struggling with relevancy, appealing to their traditional audiences, declining hunting and fishing typically in most states, and what folks are doing about it. So did come back with a draft relevancy roadmap that's got a lot of great information into it. I think, frankly, hopefully not to be too arrogant, but I think we're doing quite, we're ahead of the curve on this. I didn't hear a lot there that was different than anything I've heard internally, and I think we actually are taking a more holistic look at relevancy than other agencies. Commissioner?
Yeah, thank you, sir. Is offal pulling together best practices from 56?
That's part of the relevancy roadmap, yeah. So they'll look at that. Part of it, to me, the interesting thing to me is states vary, of course, on how they define relevancy. I think we, or certainly I, am defining relevancy a lot broader than most states. I think most states are still looking, they talk about the bigger picture, but when you get into the meeting and actually the meat of the subject, it's about how to get more people hunting and fishing, which is a huge part of relevancy, but that's not the extent of relevancy to me. Relevancy is having those people not engaged in hunting and fishing. I'd love as many as we can to do that, but those that aren't and never will be, we need to be relevant to them as well. And I think that's a step ahead.
Does OFWA have a working group dedicated to that?
They have a relevancy working group, yes.
Okay, so we can monitor what they produce.
Yeah, we will definitely leverage that information. I think we're going to, in my opinion, want to be out ahead of it, use it to springboard ahead of where they're at.
In your communication with OFWA, could you ask for that relevancy group to have a briefing at OFWA?
I can do that.
Yeah, I think that would be
of value. You can send them the link to the OFWA report, too.
Yeah, and we'll send you the link to the relevancy roadmap.
Yeah, thank you.
Talked about the letter already. Attended on September 28th, National Hunting and Fishing Day. So this was a pretty inspirational day for me. Commissioner Anderson was there as well. I think he's the only one I ran into there of the commissioners. We early in the morning, there was a line, a couple football fields long, 600 kids pre-registered. Great day. These are a lot of kids in particular are youth that haven't gotten the exposure to the things that we promote and regulate. So there were hands-on fishing, shooting, archery, and man, I've never seen as many big smiles in one place as you saw there. And so this is one of those things that I think our staff did a spectacular job, so kudos to them. And this is something I think we need to invest in. It was huge, and it needs to be 10 times bigger each year. This is really a place to grab the attention and the inspiration for those youth. And a lot of the adults I talked to were so happy. They don't have access to help. They would love to see their kids get involved in this, but they don't have that experience themselves. This was a perfect opportunity. Staff did a remarkable job. So it was a better day on the job, I'll say, even if it was a Saturday.
Yeah, can I just make an acknowledgement? I'm organized by our Hunter Education Group, and They do a fabulous job. I think it's an opportunity to highlight what an important small program that is in our department.
Yeah, and the activities put on there were so far-ranging. Yes, Hunter Ed is really the core of it, but it goes so much beyond that,
exactly.
And it's growing. So it's that great thing. Had a habitat meeting with the Stillaguamish tribe. So I highlight this one for a couple of reasons. One, it's part of the finalizing a management unit profile with the tribe in order that we can get management plan for Puget Sound so we can get into north of Falcon. So it's really a big part of that. But it's hinging on habitat, which is a good thing, I think, for us. We're trying to broaden those discussions beyond just harvest. Had a good meeting with them. Partner with them. Great input from Region 4. Going to develop a regular meeting with them. Hope to do this with multiple tribes to actually help each other get conservation on the ground, get those habitat projects in place so we can start turning around some of these runs so we provide, hopefully, some relief on those constraining stocks. So I think a great step in the right direction, a lot of work left to do, but really, again, kudos to our staff who are really reaching out and trying to coordinate with those tribes to get that meaningful progress on the ground.
Because I live not far from there, I hear things from even some of the tribal folks that I know. The sense I got was this habitat thing was kind of an impediment and had things slowed down quite a bit. Is that true? And what are we doing to try and clarify that if it was a problem?
So I want to be cautious not to call it out as the problem, but it was part of the discussion amongst many things, including exploitation rates and thresholds for exploitation rates. Habitat assistance or coordination was on the table as well. It's one of the last ones to be kind of wrapped up. What we've done is work closely with the tribe, went up and met with the tribe directly with our regional staff and Habitat, our new Habitat director, to meet with them, and have followed up with their chairman since. So it's part of the equation. I would love to see it to be part of the equation in every management unit profile in greater depth. So I wouldn't say it's a problem, but it's an area where they're looking for us to do more.
And continue.
Yeah.
Commissioner Anderson. Yeah, I guess I would really like to encourage you to personally stay on top of that particular issue, because we all know the implications of the Stillaguamish system for North Falcon and peace and harmony and process. And so the tribe has been very focused on habitat issues over the years, and we're overwhelmed with that as the major problem. And I would just strongly encourage you and others to keep that focus really tight and find success on this.
Certainly do our best. Legislative tour in Iscagget, I did not attend this, but it was well attended. It was kicked off by Representative Lakanoff from the Swinomish tribe, Swinomish tribe and representative, along with Lummi. So a good opportunity. We've had those trips many times. Certainly to be continued, and this commission has heard a lot of testimony around the challenges in that area. I think it's noteworthy that we're not hearing as much, and so I want to reach, you know, offer kudos to staff and tribal partners in that area for there, we haven't reached peace and harmony in the valley, I think is how you praised it, but we've certainly moved in that direction, largely Amy's leadership when she was the regional director. We've got a lot of work left to do, but it's an example of if we get together and work together, we can make it better, and then we'll just have to keep at it to get to the final goal. Attended a Yakima Nation State Agency Summit this week. So the Yakimas are not signatory to the Centennial Accord, so they have this annual event about every other year. they're trying to get that up to an annual. It's just a lot to pull off. And so it's basically their version, and a lot of it was intended to really focus on how to best work with the Yakima Nation. So that was the morning session with their chair. Heard a lot about the nation's basis for their petition or their effort to remove the lower three Columbia dams. Was intended to help us work better together, and then we had breakout sessions in the afternoon with the natural resource agencies. Overall, very good meeting. Follow-up with Phil Rigdon to occur on our issues. Our issues, of course, are big ones. Tribal hunting was probably at the top of their list, particularly for the chairman. And I'll get to that on other tribal engagements as well. That's going to be one of our hardest issues here in the next period of time. Also met with the Chehalis tribe, working primarily on their role and impact in the Chehalis Basin. So this is the deliberation over whether there's a flood control structure there or not. We're working with them both on the habitat side of this and on the science side of evaluating the impacts of that dam. Very, very concerned. So it's a dynamic with the Chehalis tribe, Quinault tribe together. We serving a technical role to the Department of Ecology on an environmental impact statement. So we're working closely with those tribes, both tribes, to try to make sure that we stay coordinated on that so that we can make sure we work through this process. We're also working closely, of course, with our sister agencies at the state level. A lot more to follow on that one. Upcoming meetings, I just mentioned tribal hunting. We've got a lot of energy around tribal hunting right now. I'll reach out to Nate, who's been our superstar at carrying this baggage for a long time, or this load for a long time. Total disagreement amongst tribes on exactly how we would exercise our discretion, enforcement discretion, on tribal hunters hunting outside their reservation and outside their ceded land in particular. So we've got a court case, the Buchanan case, that describes how that should occur. Tribes are not in agreement with that. We have reached agreements with tribes individually over the last 10 years or so. Our criteria and level of rigor has varied over time, so the agreements are, I won't say the agreements are not inconsistent, but the basis and the process to get to an agreement have been inconsistent. So we're pushing hard to have a kind of a reset for everybody, bring all tribes in and talk about what does it really mean, how do we get to this. We emphasize that we are not trying to adjudicate, we have no authority to, or frankly no interest to adjudicate treaty rights. That said, if another treaty member is hunting what you perceive to be your area, the state's only want some jurisdiction to do something. So tribes want us to stay out until they want us to be in and defend their side of the argument is really what it boils down to. So we have scheduled a meeting for October 30th, asked all tribes, treaty tribes, to come in and have a discussion on how can we hit that reset. Generally, I think I would say there's interest in our appreciation for that meeting. The real challenge is going to be we're going to propose whatever process it is. We're probably looking at a couple years to get to completion. We estimate it'll take a year to get through a process, agreement on what the process is, and then we have to apply that process to each of the tribes, which will take the next increment of time. So that leaves us for a couple of years with the question of what do you do while you're developing this bigger process. So part of the question for the 30s will be, are tribes bought into the idea? Tribes generally, I know we won't reach consensus. That's been perfectly clear to us. Do they want to engage generally in that broader process? If so, what are we going to do for this interim process? And a lot of completely disparate ideas on how that should occur. So this is one of our more challenging topics.
Commissioner Thorburn.
And just a couple of questions on that. The Buchanan case was the one out of Wyoming?
Well, it's a state. It's a state.
Oh, it's a state
of Washington Supreme Court.
Oh, okay.
So the treaty, the general treaty language, it varies by treaty, but this language is pretty consistent. That, you know, that you can fish at usual in the customs grounds and stations, and hunt. You can also hunt, but that hunt, it's a privilege to hunt, and it's not defined. It was not defined through a Bolt case. The Buchanan case described a traditional hunting area that tribes can use. Or have a treaty right to, but it doesn't go on to tell us how you define what a traditional hunting area is, other than to say it was used and occupied for extended periods of time. So each tribe views it differently. A lot of tribes are suggesting that's just ceded land. Other tribes are suggesting it's throughout the territory of Washington. So there's obviously a lot of difference between those two interpretations.
And some disagreement among tribes on ceded land as
even the ceded
overlap.
Even the ceded land is not clear. So we've put a lot of work into this through the
right.
years. I think that Yeoman's work came up with a set of guidelines, hired an independent anthropologist, applied those guidelines. What we sent them out this year for in order to get that broader holistic approach. Here's how we'd like to approach this for all tribes. Tribes, what do you think of these guidelines? The thing we heard most loud and clear was you need to engage us in developing the guidelines. It felt like you're pushing them down on us. I don't want to be too defensive, but we asked for that engagement, and they said, give us your guidelines.
Yeah.
We gave them the guidelines, and they said, involve us in developing these guidelines. So it's an iterative step. I think we're at the point now where we said, okay, we'll pause our guidelines that we've already developed while we talk to you about what are the right guidelines. That's the October 30th meeting.
Thank you. Larry.
Commissioner Ludwig.
I have, I'm sure there was language around the closed area of the Clackam. Did that get discussed specifically?
Or at the Yakima Nation?
Yeah.
Yeah, basically it got discussed enough for Phil Rigdon, their natural resources director, to say he'll follow up with us. Their view is they have a treaty right to hunt up there, and the fact that we choose not to hunt there doesn't change their perspective. We asked him to sit down with us and have a broader discussion on that.
I would have the concern that I think there's maybe some public safety issue around that now. The language that I'm hearing is pretty strong from... Sorry for this term, from non-native hunters, there's more. And I just worry, the Clackam's already a little bit nutty.
Emotional.
Thank you, much better word. And so I would just ask that the department be thoughtful about if there's anything that they can do to, bring the temperature, especially during elk season, down a little bit around that. Until something is reached and clarity is reached.
Yeah, I certainly don't want to suggest that work like that has to be delayed while we develop this broader process.
Right.
We met, talked to, that was one of the topics that came up very briefly at the end because it's really just a fish and wildlife issue, and other people are glad to stay out of it, other agencies. But we specifically asked Phil to sit down with us and talk about it. I think what we'll need to do is work through that and then put a proposal in front of their tribal council. I'm going to speed up a little bit. I'm going to try at least. We're also gearing up for North of Falcon. That fund starts here soon. Have a steering committee with the Northwest Indian Fish Commission representatives and a meeting with NOAA Fisheries on October 31st to kind of set the sideboards for how we go forward with this year's North of Falcon effort. So that will be with Barry Tom on the 31st. Also have a Billy Frank Jr. Salmon Summit coming up on November 5th where we sit down with tribes. I will send out an agenda for y'all so you know what we're talking about there. I have it here somewhere, but in the interest of time, I'm going to skip forward. Probably one of the bigger things we'll have coming up is the Centennial Accord this year is November 6th and 7th at the Suquamish. So this is the meeting. It's the Centennial Accord signed in at the Centennial of the State on how we work government to government with tribes. Typically, most tribal chairs are there, and it's a meeting with the governor and his agencies and state agencies. And so we have a big chunk of that agenda. part of it is on co-management of wildlife, which was basically mostly be focused on the tribal hunting I've already discussed. I think I'm going to skip a few things. Quickly, typically these updates include wolves. We heard from the Wolf Committee, so I think you heard most of it. We do have the letter from the governor asking us to figure out a better solution for those areas in the Northeast with a requested report due December 1st. I think Commissioner Thorburn talked about that, so we're working on that. Also, usually the general concern or interest here is where we're at on various lethal removals. We removed one wolf from the Grouse Flats, a pack. That is now on pause, so that order is now suspended. We have a standing order on the Togo pack, but we haven't had any depredations or any opportunities to execute that order, so that one's kind of in still officially on the books, but we're somewhat in a limbo there on how to proceed. Good news is we're coming to the end of the grazing season, as you heard, and we haven't had depredations for at least a month, I think, out there, so that's good news. The last thing I think it's important to hear about is as you all know, we've put a lot of energy into working on the culture of the agency, making sure we have that diverse, inclusive, equitable, safe environment. I'm really happy to say that we've got a great lead on that. Our Deputy Director, Amy, is our lead for our efforts on cultural improvements in the agency, and so I'm going to ask her to hit the highlights where we've been working on that, and that'll be the end of my report.
Okay, thank you, Chair Carpenter. We're always on this path to a more respectful work environment, and part of that path is being really clear about where we're headed. You know, like what are the values that we share as staff that we can hold ourselves and each other accountable to, and how the public can hold us accountable to our behavior. And so we've been working on articulating our values for how we implement our mission over the last year and a half, and we have a working draft of those values that we're just starting to roll out to staff. The values, there are five of them. It's professionalism, accountability, respect, integrity, and empathy. So we'll be working on what that means to staff, what that means, how we demonstrate those behaviors over the coming couple of years, and then we'll hopefully revisit them in a couple of years and say, okay, do we need to refine these? Is there something that we're missing? Relative to being on that path for a respectful work environment is making sure that we have a good way for staff to identify when they feel we're not living those values. And one of the things that we have I don't think we're unique as a state agency, but we have a lot of people that work remotely. They work far from headquarters. They work far from their colleagues. They work in remote hatcheries, wildlife areas. They're out at creel sampling. And so we want to make sure that those folks, everybody in our agency, has the ability to document and communicate when they feel like they are working in an environment that is not safe or respectful. So we've contracted with a third-party reporting tool called Red Flag Reporting. It's an anonymous reporting tool, and that will be available to staff starting November 1. So that's a new thing for us. We, given our history of sexual harassment and sexual violence here at the department, we are really mindful about how to move forward together as a staff in creating a new future. The State Auditor's Office has decided to audit our culture, which is something they have not done before. We're sort of the first state agency they're looking at. So that audit is happening now. The data will be gathered from staff. They're doing a series of focus groups throughout the state. They have also a reporting line that people can just call in and anonymously share their experience with the culture of Department of Fish and Wildlife. That report will come out, I believe, in April, June or so of next year. But I wanted you to know that was in the works. If you go to the State Auditor's Office website, you can kind of get a one-page write-up of what they're looking at. And I think, did we announce the new program directors?
Not since
September.
Not here, yeah.
Okay, we'd like to also welcome our new program directors. We have Kelly Cunningham as our fish program director and Morgan Carlson as our habitat program director. So, welcome to both of them. They started in the last week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks
Kelly
or so.
Kelly was
a little earlier. All right, I think that's it.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, Amy. Well done. just want to check and see if Commissioner Graybill's, are you still there?
I am, Chairman.
Have anything to say?
I'm awake.
Okay, have you ordered lunch yet?
Okay. I'm on my second cup of coffee.
All right, just making sure you're doing fine. All right, we're going to move into agenda item four. We're a little behind schedule, but I know Julie Sandberg is very proficient. So this is a land transaction briefing, public comment, and decision. And we will take public comment on this if there's any. Thank you, Julie. Good to see you.
Very good. Chairman, Commissioners, Director, and Deputy, my name is Julie Sandberg. I'm the Real Estate Services Manager for the agency. I have three transactions to bring before you today. The first one is located in Grays Harbor County near the town of Westport. This was first brought before you in February for the first portion of it, the north and south outlined in green. The property is currently owned by Anderson Logging Company. We are proposing to acquire the outline in red, which is 560 acres. We have worked very hard with our partner, Ducks Unlimited. They brought a National Coastal Wetland Grant to the table in the first phase and are also very involved with our restoration efforts and a lot of potential on this property for waterfowl hunting. We are also very pleased that we are getting in and getting out on our grants. We received a Recreation and Conservation Office grant just about a month ago because we had done the initial acquisition and appraisal in a timely manner. Coming back now to finish it, we can use that first appraisal and come back to you quickly and close out this transaction, hopefully by the end of the year. The appraised value for the 560 acres is $1,070,000. Although the grant is open for 3 years, we're trying to get in, get closed, and acquire the property. During the remainder of the time the grant is open, we're able to use that funding on some of our operation and maintenance costs like weed control, ground survey, and or fencing when necessary. In addition, our budgets moving forward also include any new properties we've acquired to incorporate that operation and maintenance cost. This is a very diverse... Oh, go ahead.
I mentioned that I had a question, and I'll ask it now. So one of the pieces of the grant is called a critical habitat grant in your summary. Is that federal funding, fish and wildlife? I mean, it implies critical habitat. And does what kind of requirements ongoing might be involved with that grant?
For a wide variety of species, and the more diverse, the more points you get. Again, this is a saltwater estuarine area. It serves waterfowl. It also supports a year-round elk herd. This is also a category of the Washington Wildlife and Recreation Program that requires access for the public for recreation. So it's blending those values of providing habitat but also providing recreational opportunities.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioner Thorburn. I just wanted to clarify that the concept of federally designated critical habitat is not a concept associated with this grant category. It's a state-funded grant category.
The second transaction also happens to be the second phase of a property that we brought before you in June. This is located in Yakima County. It's known as the Cowichi Van Wyk property. It has long been in the Van Wyk family, and it took a lot of work from our partner, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, to keep the landowner at the table and interested in finding the right time to go ahead and sell the property to us. We had a strong partner in this transaction with Rocky Mountain Elk and also another conservation organization, Forterra Northwest. The first phase, as I mentioned, was acquired earlier this year. The red portion is the 900 acres that we're proposing to acquire with the recent funding that we also received from the state funds, the Recreation and Conservation Office. The appraised value of the property is $954,810. And again, the operation and maintenance, we can take care of some of those initial costs out of the grant while it's open for about 3 years. But we wanted to get in and get the property closed. Because this landowner wanted to be purchased in one transaction, we were able to use our federal funding to buy the first part of it. And then Forterra Northwest stepped in and is holding the property so that we will technically be acquiring it in this red hash-marked second phase from Forterra Northwest. Part of this transaction also includes a stewardship easement that Forterra Northwest requested in order to better document their commitment to long-term stewardship. They'll help us with some of that restoration. They want to do some environmental education and interpretive work out on the property. So that's a long-term permanent commitment on the property, which is why that easement comes before you as well. The third transaction is located in southwestern Skagit County. It's known as the Fur Island Farm Easement Amendment. That's a lot of words. This transaction comes before you because... Yes, sir.
It says Snohomish County on the paperwork. That's.
Thank you. I corrected that once, and it just keeps
came back
coming
again?
Back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It wants Skagit to be in
County.
Snohomish.
I got to protect Skagit County. You know.
Thank you. The unit is part of our Fur Island Farm Snow Goose Reserve Unit. This is a long-term restoration project that involved moving back a dike like 5,500 feet. In the news this week, you heard about to the south, Lekwe Island, near Kameno, where a dike was removed, tremendous restoration project. This is a little bit further north. This particular project restored 132 acres of marshland in the estuary, and the transaction we're bringing before you today is to amend this easement. So we have an easement with the Dike District number 22, and they have rights to go on the dike road and do their necessary repairs to the dike. As we've worked on the restoration, we had to ensure the pumps were functioning. We had some nature interfere a couple years ago that slowed it down, but now everything's functioning. The dike has been moved. This is a great view looking to the northeast that shows you the natural flow now with the dike that was removed off to the lower right-hand corner of the property. This is, again, looking a little more due east across the property that shows you some new channels that were put in. The new setback dike was moved from the lower right to the upper portion where it says new setback dike. Tremendous restoration project. The region's very proud of this one. If the easement amendment is approved, then we'll go ahead and record that document, and the Diking District will take over maintenance and operation of this structure. I would be glad to answer any questions.
Are there any questions, Julie? Hearing none, is there a motion?
Yes, sir. Move to accept the recommendations put forth by Julie.
We have a motion by.
Before you usually take public comment, I don't know whether there was any, but.
No, thank you.
I haven't got any sheets, but no, there is no public comment. Oh, maybe here comes some. Let me see here. Is that on number four? Okay. All right, we have a motion from Commissioner Smith. May I have a second? We have a second from Commissioner Thorburn. Any further discussion from the front table? Hearing none, I'll call for the question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Julie, well done. Well done. We may get a break yet before too long. All right. We are now on number five and spring bear season briefing, public hearing, and there's an opportunity for public comment on this one, and I have one. So, Denise, good morning.
Good morning, commissioners. I think we have the wrong presentation.
Brad, could you snag me a water over there? Well, that's magical. Okay.
Good morning again. Today I'll be presenting WAC 220-415-80 spring black bear season and regulations. The summary outlines requirements related to participating in spring special permit seasons. Successful harvest applies towards the annual two bear bag limit. So the way we have black bears are based on bear management units. We have nine of them in the state, and they're outlined here on this map. So the way our spring bear season is by permit only, and it's usually used for areas where we have either timber issues or we are trying to help ungulate species with low reproductive rates. So those are the two kind of the two categories they fall in. Some of the adjusted changes we are proposing, given that most of the west side permits are on timberland that is usually experiencing timber damage. We do have the Kapausen hunt area, which will be closing because that landowner no longer wants to allow hunters on that property. So that precludes us from having those permits. Another change is a technical edit, basically to realign boundaries to clarify them and to indicate that U.S. Forest Service lands are excluded from that hunt. Again, those are hunts that are specifically designed to deal with timber damage issues. In the southeastern part of the state, we are recommending some increases in permits on specific GMUs, and this is designed to help with elk reproductive rates to increase calf production, basically. The Blue Creek GMU 154, we're recommending adding three permits. The Dayton GMU, we're recommending adding three permits as well. So these are going from 15 to 18. The Winaha GMU, 45 to 60, adding 15 permits. The Mountain View GMU, going from 15 to 24, adding nine permits. And then the Little Creek GMU, again, adding three permits. And we've also added a new area this year with five permits. This is also to distribute hunters into new areas where we have calving elk. The rationale, basically, for this recommendation is 38 additional permits distribute hunters in areas where ungulate survival is a concern, intended to have hunters focus on bears in calving areas, which may be beneficial to the elk calf survival. Based on five-year average harvest, we expect to harvest an additional seven bears with these permits. So it's not a large amount of increase in harvest. So the slide here basically shows the net change in permits, given that we're closing one unit that has 150 permits and then adding those 38 permits, basically 112 permit reduction overall in the spring bear hunting. This map kind of shows you the distribution. So the area in the southeast, the blue area is the area being added, and then the area delineated in red in the center of the state is the area being removed because of access issues. So we've also added language into our rule to include mandatory reporting of harvest within 72 hours of kill. We currently do not have mandatory pelt check on bears. We do have it on cougars. This is a way for us to start doing that because these are permit seasons. There's fewer of them, and the workload would not be as high. We would like to eventually look into mandatory reporting for all harvest, but we wanted to look at workload, and this is a one way to get to it in a stepwise manner. So the rationale for pelt sealing is basically it improves our harvest data, improves the quality of the harvest data, and provides for better understanding of sex and age classes in the harvest. And it also gets to the reproductive rates because you can tell whether from the pelt whether females were lactating or not and whether cubs were underground. So that gives us a lot better information for which to manage our spring bear hunt. Again, I already mentioned it, that we can get evidence of sex, which allows us, the department, to monitor the number of reproductive females and the such. So some of the public comments that we received 139 comments, 138 were online and one letter, 42 supported in general. The ones that were in opposition of the pelt ceiling majority. There were a few that were in opposition of spring bear in general for a multitude of season. So some oppose a mandatory pelt check. Potential for orphaning cubs was also one that was mentioned, and the potential to lose hunters because we're requesting them to bring the pelts. So they felt that was an onerous thing to ask hunters. Those are the recommendations for the spring bear hunting. I'm happy to take any questions.
Commissioner Lidwell.
Do you have any sense for, I also have concerns around orphaning cubs in the spring. Do you have any sense around how prevalent that is or how big of a concern? And I'm just kind of asking for a sense. I know.
Sure. I don't really have a sense, to be honest. I mean, we do know from the harvest, because it is reported, what the percentage females in the harvest are, but how many of them have cubs that heal is really hard to say. So no, I don't have a sense for it. We do say in our rules that not to shoot females with cubs, and I don't think there are any hunters out there that would want to orphan cubs. So it's, I think people that do hunt in the spring look very hard before they pull the trigger, and then the pelt ceiling information will actually give us a lot better information on that, and that is one of the reasons we've added it, is to try to get a sense of that through the harvest.
Commissioner Anderson?
Yes. A couple of comments. First off, with regard to the Kapausen change, is that a long-term change on the part of the landowner?
Likely, yes.
When would they revisit that? Could they make a request to have an increase in the future?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we revisit these permits annually, so if their position changes, this could change, yes.
But that's probably not likely.
Not likely, no.
And was it an access issue, or was it?
Yeah, they didn't feel the program was helping them to the extent that the access was. So it was just kind of a cost benefit analysis on their point of view. I can't speak to their. Okay. Their need. So, I mean, it was their decision, not ours. So.
Okay. Secondly, with regard to the blues and the increase permits over there, and it was justified around concern about elk populations and neonate impact. To what extent, or how comfortable are you that impact is bear-driven versus cats or wolves?
So, I mean, how comfortable? So we base, there are studies in that area that indicate how many calves, you know, are taken by bears and other things. Obviously, I'm not saying bears are the only issue. They are one of the predators on the landscape, and, you know, we are only talking about bear season at this point. So if are there other predators that are taking calves? Obviously there are. To what extent? We don't have more recent information on that.
I guess following up on that, my concern is that that additional information seems very critical as it relates to concerns that the commission is dealing with regarding cougars and wolves, and trying to understand what's happening to that elk population there seems to be critical, and that it's not, I wouldn't want to stop just with, you know, thought that maybe bear is the primary predator impact. I'd like to have a good handle on the elk population overall, and whether or not these other predators are causing some problems. And I don't know how to phrase the question, but it.
So yeah, I mean, to address your concern, we are looking at that. But right now, the spring bear loo comes at this time because of the season and when people have to apply for the bear.
I got that.
The bear permit. So we are not. This isn't an all-inclusive, predator management presentation. It's only dealing with spring bear. And by dealing with spring bear, we're bringing you recommendations to address that issue for spring bear only. Now, we are looking at other issues affecting those elk herds, and we haven't come to a conclusion yet of what the other predators may be affecting it.
Yeah, I'd be interested in that, obviously, and looking forward to hearing more about the additional analysis.
Commissioner Thorburn?
Just to kind of add to some of the points that Jim, I think, is making, I want to express my enthusiastic support for the reporting requirements that are involved in this. I think it's going to provide us with valuable data on a hunt where there is this concern. Are we killing moms with cubs at heel? You emphasized that this is really a hunt that is fashioned as much for conflict as for opportunity. I know it's a popular hunt with bear hunters, but in that line, we do handle bear conflict in other ways, and we've been working on that. We haven't heard anything, but there was a working group that was put together, and we've been proceeding on changing that, and I just want to raise that, and maybe you can talk a little bit about how the two complement one another.
Certainly. Two different methods of one way is dealing with population dynamics, and the other one is dealing with the specific bears that are peeling. So when we talk in conflict, we're talking peeling of trees. I want to separate the ungulate part of it from the peeling. Most of the west side hunts are designed to try to deal with population levels of bears in areas where peeling is an issue. We do have a program that deals with individual bears that are peeling, where we issue permits to landowners to pursue those individual bears, either using hounds or other methods. There was a lawsuit on that program, and we were not able to use that tool last year. We have since, had a favorable decision from the court, and it looks like we still have that tool. There is a pending, any other litigation. We are going to move forward with that program. We are hoping to convene a group of stakeholders and then maybe codify some of the things that we currently have in our permits and put them more into rules. So the time frame for that is still open, just because the litigation just barely wrapped up. So we're just basically re-looking at how we're going to move forward with all of that. So I don't have more to share on that process than that. But obviously that tool is still in our toolbox. We use it in specific areas that deal with a specific animal.
Thanks. Commissioner Linville?
I'm curious what the reporting would look like. Is this the hunter driving to a department office, or how?
Yes.
That's a pretty tight window.
It's actually 5 days after they report the harvest. So 72 hours to report it, and then they have 5 days
So
it's actually a very long time frame. It's a lot quicker right now for the cougar reporting. So when we do it for all cougars are mandatory currently, and they're not by permit. This is just a permit only, and harvest is fairly limited. So, yeah, it is an additional burden on the hunter, but it will get us information that will help us maintain the ability to have a spring bear hunt, because spring bear hunting is very controversial, and so the more information we have, the better we're able to manage those hunts.
So kind of on top of that, because it's also I'm very much in favor of getting that data, so don't hear me the wrong way. We know, like, it's also a burden on department staff as well. And right. Do you have the department staff at the likely locations to handle it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's only 500 or so permits, and then harvest rate is, a fairly low. So we're only expecting roughly a couple of hundred animals to be harvested through all of this hunting. So I think we do have, and this is a way for us to gauge what capacity we have if we do want to move into the same concept under the general season framework. So that's kind of our dipping our toe in the water, so to speak, to see how it would work. And if we find that it is a workload issue, we may do it for a few years, get the information, and then back off of it. But I don't think it will be a workload issue.
Going back a minute to the damage peeling hunts, which are separate from the recreational hunts, my question is there any agreements in place? For instance, in Kapausen, now they are going to shut their they're going to shut down bear hunting there. But if they have peeling issues, will we go in and do hunts on that property to alleviate that? Or since they've shut it down, do we say no? Do we have contractual or otherwise agreements in place in that regard?
No, we do not. So if they do have issues in specific areas, we will go in and we will help them with that issue.
Okay. We have one individual for open public comment, then we'll move forward on this. Sophia Ressler.
Barbara, that's a good question. If there's some leverage.
Nice handwriting, Sophia. I wish I could do as well anywhere.
My name is Sophia Ressler. I'm here on behalf of the Center for Biological Diversity. As most of you already know, we're a nonprofit conservation group. We have over 1.6 million members and supporters, and over 36,000 of those are in Washington State. I'll focus on just one of the things in the presentation first. Our members and supporters are obviously also very concerned about cub stranding, so we appreciate the idea of getting more information about that in order to figure out, what's going on and how we might be able to prevent that further. But I also want to just talk high level. In May of this year, I sent a letter to the commission asking the commission to postpone the decision on the 2009 fall bear hunting rule in order to review a forthcoming study that we had gotten wind of, which supposedly contained information that showed that Washington's black bear numbers were much lower than previously believed. I'm not aware of this study having been released at present, but I admit that I haven't been paying very close attention, so I apologize if that has been released and I just haven't seen it yet. But regardless of whether that study has been released or not, the fall bear hunting decision was made without review of that study. And I just want to use that example simply to urge the commission to use the best available science in making these wildlife management decisions. And if that means postponing votes a little to have that new information, I would strongly urge the commission to do so and to consider the study that I referred to in making these spring hunting rules. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Baker.
I want to thank Sophia for that suggestion. That was an issue that I raised when we did, when we approved the fall bear hunt, and I was the only person to vote against that. But this is a question for Anise then, because I asked the question then, And I believe, just thinking back on it, that the answer was that those the studies that were coming out, well, first off, hasn't been released. And second of off, I was fairly assured that the study wasn't a population study, that it was about other things. So can you address that, Anise?
Certainly. Yeah, so the research was done in-house. So, I mean, we have that information, and we always base our decisions on the information that we have. The study has not been published yet, but has been accepted. And the study is not a statewide population level. It looked at two different areas in the state and gave us a density for those areas. From that study, we've decided to do more monitoring in more parts of the state to get a density estimate of bears statewide. So we do not have a statewide density estimate based on those studies. We have population estimates for those areas where they conducted those studies. And then it does show a different density than we have seen, but it's actually higher on the east side than when we based it on before, and a little bit lower on the west side than we based it before. So to extrapolate that to statewide, it would be a false approach to take. So yeah, we do have studies that show that densities vary, and so from that, what we took is we need to be managing differently, and we are starting to monitor cougar populations with the same methodology around the state, and it'll be a rotating system where we get to eventually the entire state and figure out what densities are.
Bear,
I'm sorry, what did I say? Cougar, yeah. Sorry, I've got cougar on the brain.
We have a comment from Commissioner Smith.
Yeah, thanks, Denise. You said it's been accepted, but it hasn't been published yet. Right?
Correct, yeah.
And do you know the pub date on that? Or?
I don't. I just reviewed a version of it, and I know that's...
Could you share that when it comes out with us? Because
yes.
I think it would be beneficial reading.
Yeah,
thank
you. You bet.
Okay, good job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to a break. So what we will do is, let's see, we're in pretty good shape right now. Let's take 15.